You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity. We are launching into a crucial deep dive today, one that underpins almost every single hemodynamic decision we make in the operating room, the fundamental physiology of venous return.
It really is the engine room, isn't it? I mean, we focus so much on cardiac output, CO, and stroke volume.
Right.
But, you know, as Guyton established way back over half a century ago now, the amount of blood the heart pumps out is exactly equal to the amount of blood that returns to the right atrium venous return, VR.
So simple, yet so profound.
Yeah, if VR dictates CO, then controlling VR is circulatory control. It's that straightforward, fundamentally.
Exactly. And for us, as anesthesiologists, managing hemodynamics really means managing that flow back to the heart. Every single thing we do, giving a fluid bolus, cranking up the PEEP, titrating norepinephrine, it's all, at its core, a venous return intervention. So our goal in this deep dive is to really internalize the Arthur Guyton framework, hopefully turning our actions from, you know, sometimes reactive guesswork into targeted predictive maneuvers.
Absolutely. Guyton's work in the 50s, it was just revolutionary because it shifted the focus. It wasn't just about the heart being the, you know, the master controller.
Right, the pump itself.
Yeah, it was about the peripheral circulation too. He basically established that the circulation is this unified system defined by two intersecting relationships. You've got the physical flow gradient driving VR.
The push.
The push, exactly. And then you have the mechanical pump function described by the Frank-Starling mechanism.
The heart's response.
Right. And where those two forces meet, that intersection point, that's your patient's hemodynamic steady state. That's where they're operating.
And that roadmap is just absolutely essential for avoiding those classic, sometimes terrifying pitfalls we see. I mean, let's think about some clinical consequences right off the bat when we forget this relationship. Consider inducing a patient who's already pretty dry, maybe a trauma patient waiting for that RSI.
Okay, yeah, classic scenario. You give the propofol.
And boom.
And the pressure just tanks. The immediate reaction, the sort of knee jerk, is to blame myocardial depression.
Always. Propofol stun the heart.
But often, the primary issue, the first domino, is the propofol's potent venodilation. It just massively relaxes the veins.
So it hits the venous side first.
Hits the venous side hard, and that drastically reduces the mean systemic filling pressure, or MSFP. That's the upstream driving force we'll talk loads about.
Okay.
That sudden acute drop in VR, that's the initial hemodynamic disaster. It often happens before any really profound drop in contractility kicks in.
That's a critical distinction. Or how about managing ARDs? You know, you need high PEEP, positive end expiratory pressure.
Right. High PEEP is often necessary for oxygenation.
But that PEEP translates directly into increased pressure inside the chest, which means increased atrial pressure or ROP.
Exactly. So you're effectively raising the downstream back pressure, the dam height, if you will.
Right.
And that narrows that critical gradient, the difference between the driving pressure and the back pressure suppressing VR. So you're potentially improving oxygenation.
But at the direct cost of circulatory flow, it's a trade-off.
It's always a trade-off. And think about why drugs like norepinephrine are so incredibly effective in vasodilatory states, like septic shock.
Yeah, everyone reaches for the norepi in sepsis.
And we think of it mainly as an arterial constrictor, you know, clamping down arteries to raise pressure. But a huge part of its action is profound venoconstriction.
Squeezing the veins.
Squeezing the veins, exactly. That action mobilizes blood from that sort of non-functional venous reservoir, the unstressed volume, into the active circulation, the stressed volume. That increases the MSFP, restores the VR gradient.
Okay, so it's effectively giving volume back to the system, but pharmacologically.
Precisely. And finally, just think about something as simple as patient positioning. Seems pretty benign, right?
Yeah, head up, head down.
You put a patient in steep reverse Trendelenburg, maybe for a thyroid case or pelvic surgery.
Yeah.
Suddenly, you've created this hydrostatic column.
Gravity.
Gravity is now working against you. It increases hydrostatic resistance, causes venous pooling in the legs, and it throttles the flow back to the right atrium. Every single change we make, fluid, drug, vent setting, position, it's an equation modifier.
That's our mission then.
Yeah.
Mastering the math, or at least the concepts behind the math.
That's the goal. Okay, so let's really ground this discussion in the core physics of flow. Venous return, it's a flow rate, right? Volume per unit time.
Yep.
And it has to follow that fundamental principle. Flow is proportional to the pressure gradient driving it, divided by the resistance opposing it, Ohm's law, basically.
And the real beauty, I think, of Guyton's model is how it takes this incredibly complex cardiovascular system and, you know, kind of boils it down to the simple modified Ohm's law framework. Give us that equation again, nice and clear.
Okay, so venous return, VR, equals the pressure gradient divided by venous resistance, which we call our velodrome. And that gradient is the mean systemic filling pressure, MSFP, minus the right atrial pressure, RAP. So the full equation is Viva Lawler equals MSFP, RAP, RVUE, that's it. That defines the flow of blood from the entire periphery back to the central pump.
Let's really spend some time digging into these variables because understanding them is key. Starting with MSFP, you called it the upstream driving pressure, the reservoir pressure. Mm-hmm. What does that physically represent? It sounds a bit abstract.
It is a bit abstract because you can't just put a transducer on it easily. But theoretically, MSFP is the single uniform pressure you'd measure everywhere in the circulation if you could instantly stop the heart.
Okay, total circulatory standstill.
Yeah, and allow the blood to rapidly redistribute and equilibrate. It reflects the tension, the elastic recoil created by the effective circulating volume pushing against the walls of the whole system, but mainly the compliant venous vessels. It's the total pressure head pushing blood back toward the right atrium.
And what sort of number are we talking about typically?
In a healthy, you know, euvolemic person, it's typically around 7 to 10 millimeters of mercury. Not a huge number, but it's the starting point.
Okay. Then we have RAP. Right? Atrial pressure. This is the one we do measure clinically, or at least estimate with CVP, central venous pressure. You called it the downstream opposing pressure, the back pressure. Why is it so critical functionally?
Well, RAP is the pressure at the point of entry to the heart. It basically determines how hard it is for the venous blood to get into the right atrium. If the pressure in the atrium is too high,
the door is closed, essentially.
Pretty much. The peripheral pressure, the MSFP, can't overcome it and flow just slows down or stops. You can think of it as sort of the effective atmospheric pressure for the circulation that the venous system has to pump against. Mm. And a key thing is that even a small change in RAP can cause a large change in the VR gradient, because MSFP is often a relatively stable number, while RAP can be quite volatile, especially with ventilation.
Right. The difference, MSFP, RAP, is very sensitive to RAP changes. Okay, and finally, arrhythmia venous resistance. We often kind of gloss over this one, I think, because arterial resistance, SVR, gets all the attention. But thirsty vials is crucial, too.
Absolutely crucial. Thirsty vials is the impediment to flow specifically in the venous channels. Now, normally, the systemic venous system is designed to be a low-resistance, high-capacitance system, big floppy veins.
Like big rivers, not narrow pipes.
Exactly. But Fortivi still encompasses factors like, well, the actual diameter of those venous channels, the viscosity of the blood itself.
Thicker blood flows slower.
Right. And things like external compression, which we see a lot in surgery.
Okay. We can maybe use a quick mental model here. The classic plumbing analogy seems helpful.
Yeah, it's a good starting point. MSFP is like the water level in your overhead tank that determines the potential energy, the push.
Got it.
RAP is like the height of the outlet pipe, maybe your sink drain, that determines the back pressure the water has to overcome to flow out.
Makes sense.
And RVULs, that's how narrow or maybe how clogged the pipe itself is. That limits the maximum flow rate, even if the tank is full and the drain is low.
That helps visualize it. Tank, drain, pipe narrowness.
It's a decent analogy, but the real clinical pearl here, the thing we absolutely need to internalize for practice, is that VR is driven by the gradient. The difference, MSFP, RAP. It's not driven by absolute preload numbers alone, like looking at a CVP of 8 and saying preload is okay.
Right. That CVP of 8 could mean anything without knowing MSFP.
Exactly. You could have a CVP of 12, which sounds high, but if your MSFP is way up at 20 because you've given pressors, you still have a healthy 8 millimil HG driving gradient, healthy VR.
Okay.
Conversely, if your MSFP has crashed down to 7, maybe after induction, then even a seemingly low CVP of 5 gives you a tiny gradient of only 2 millimil HG. Your VR is going to be terrible.
So the absolute CVP number is almost useless in isolation.
Pretty much. As anesthesiologists, we have to think and intervene in terms of gradient optimization. How do I increase the MSFP, or how do I decrease the RAP, or sometimes how do I decrease $2?
Okay, so once we've got that core equation, 5LER equals MSFP, RAP, RAP, RV1, burned into our brains, we can move to the visual representation, the Guyton curves. This is where the physics of flow meets the biology of the heart pump.
Precisely. It's a graphical model, and it's incredibly powerful for predicting what's going to happen. We plot two key relationships on the same graph, both against the common variable, RAP, on the x-axis.
All right. RAP is the linking variable.
Yes. The first curve is the venous return curve. The second is the cardiac function curve, which is basically the Frank-Starling relationship plotted differently.
Okay, let's take the VR curve first. You described it earlier, but graphically, it's always downward sloping. Explain that relationship again. Why does VR fall as RAP rises?
It goes straight back to the equation. As RAP, the back pressure on the x-axis increases, the numerator of our core equation, MSFP RAP, gets smaller and smaller.
The gradient shrinks.
The gradient shrinks, so the flow, VR, decreases. It's essentially a linear relationship. As RAP goes up, VR goes down, until you hit that critical point where RAP becomes equal to MSFP.
The point where the gradient is zero.
Exactly. Gradient is zero, MSFP RAP equals zero, so VR is zero. Flow stops. That downward sloping line defines the pressure head available from the periphery to drive blood back to the heart for a given MSFP and three fallers.
Got it. Then we overlay the cardiac function curve. This one is usually upward sloping, at least initially. What does this represent?
This curve represents the heart's intrinsic ability to pump blood out. It's the Frank-Starling mechanism in action. As RAP rises, which reflects right ventricular filling pressure or preload.
More stretch on the heart muscle.
More stretch, exactly. So the heart responds by increasing its stroke volume and therefore its cardiac output, CO. This happens up to a certain point, of course, where the curve starts to plateau or even fall in severe failure.
The limits of the Frank-Starling mechanism.
Right. So this upward sloping curve defines the capacity of the pump to respond to the incoming flow.
And the magic happens where these two curves cross.
That's the equilibrium point, the intersection. That single point on the graph represents the patient's actual hemodynamic status in a steady state. Why? Because at that point, the venous return VR flowing into the heart is exactly equal to the cardiac output CO being pumped out by the heart.
VR, CO. The system is balanced.
The system is balanced. And crucially, all our clinical interventions, fluids, drugs, ventilation, are designed to shift one or both of these curves and therefore move that intersection point to a more favorable location, usually meaning a higher CO.
Okay, let's visualize those shifts then. Say we want to increase VR and CO. We need to increase the driving gradient, primarily by raising MSFP. You mentioned giving fluids or administering norepinephrine.
Mm-hmm.
How does that look on the graph?
Both fluids and norepinephrine shift the entire VR curve rightward.
The whole line moves right.
The whole line moves right. Fluids increase the total stress volume, which directly increases MSFP. Norepinephrine increases venous tone, converting unstressed to stressed volume, which also increases MSFP.
A rightward shift of the VR curve means that for any given RAP, the venous return will be higher. The intersection point with the fixed CO curve will therefore move up and to the right.
Meaning higher CO, usually at a slightly higher RAT too, right?
Often, yes. You get more flow, but the filling pressure might rise a bit too.
Okay, what about the bad shifts? When we induce with propofol or maybe run high concentrations of volatile agents, you said we cause venodilation and drop MSFP.
Correct. That drop in MSFP shifts the entire VR curve leftward.
The opposite direction.
The opposite direction. Now, for any given RAP, the VR is lower. The equilibrium point crashes downwards, often dramatically resulting in lower CO and hypotension.
And this really highlights why giving an MSFP depressor like propofol is so dangerous in someone who's already hypovolemic, isn't it?
Absolutely. Because their starting VR curve is already shifted to the left due to low volume.
Yeah.
Then you hit them with propofol, shifting it even further left. The drop in CO can be precipitous.
Okay. Now, what if we add PEEP? You said it increases RAP. How does that affect the curves? PEEP is a bit different. It doesn't fundamentally change the MSFP itself. The total volume and venous tone aren't directly altered.
Right.
But it does raise the effective RAP by increasing intrathoracic pressure. Graphically, this is best represented as shifting the VR curve downward, or you could think of it as effectively raising the zero flow pressure point on the RAP axis.
Now the whole curve kind of pivots down.
It effectively pivots down or shifts down. The result is the same. For any given MSFP, the resulting VR flow is lower because the back pressure is higher. The intersection point moves down and to the left, lower CO.
Got it. And what about shifting the other curve, the cardiac function curve? That's about the pump itself.
Exactly. That's all about contractility and afterload. If you give an inotrope like dobutamine or epinephrine.
Makes the heart squeeze harder.
Squeeze harder, yes. That shifts the CO curve upward. Now, for the same filling pressure, REP, the heart can achieve a higher cardiac output. The intersection point moves up.
And conversely?
Conversely, things that depress myocardial function, maybe high-dose beta blockers, or severe myocardial depression from, say, an acute MI, or even high concentrations of volatiles, again, they shift the CO curve downward. Less pump for the same fill.
This graphical approach really lets us predict the outcome more precisely, doesn't it? Like, if you have a septic patient, Their VR curve has already shifted left because sepsis causes vasodilation, low MSFP.
Right, low MSFP.
And then you decide to add an inotrope, shifting the CO curve up.
Okay.
The new equilibrium point, the new CO, might still be pretty limited, right? Because the VR curve is still way over to the left. The heart might be capable of pumping more, but the flow simply isn't getting back to it.
That confirms the clinical reality perfectly. You can't pump what you haven't got back. That's why in many vasodilatory shock states, fixing the VR first, using pressors like norepinephrine to shift that VR curve right by boosting MSFP is often the more immediate and effective first step rather than just trying to flog the heart harder with inotropes alone.
The map tells you which problem to tackle first.
Precisely. It clarifies the primary target for intervention.
All right, let's dive deeper into that first determinant. MSFP means systemic filling pressure. You called it the true upstream pressure, the reservoir. Why is this determinant, which sounds so important, generally so hard to track clinically? And maybe unpack this concept of stressed versus unstressed volume a bit more?
Yeah, MSFP is tricky to track directly because, as we said, the gold standard measurement requires stopping flow-inducing circulatory arrest, basically.
Which we generally try to avoid.
Generally trying to avoid, yes. So we have to rely on estimations or surrogates. But understanding the concept is critical. To get it, you really need to grasp how blood volume is distributed. Think of the entire vascular system, especially the veins, as this huge compliant reservoir, like a giant sponge.
Yeah, a sponge.
Most of the blood volume, maybe 70 to 75%, just sits in the veins and venules under normal conditions. This is the unstressed volume.
Unstressed meaning it's not really creating pressure.
Exactly. It fills the space within the vessels, but because the venous walls are so compliant, so stretchy at low volumes, this volume doesn't really stretch them enough to generate significant elastic recoil or pressure. It's just kind of there.
Filling the container.
Filling the container without pushing outwards much. The remaining 25 to 30% of the blood volume is the stressed volume. This is the portion that is actively stretching the elastic walls of the vessels, mainly the veins and venules.
So this is the volume that's actually generating the pressure.
This is the volume generating the pressure, the elastic recoil. It's the volume above the baseline capacity of the system. You only generate significant pressure when you fill the sponge beyond its resting capacity and start stretching the fibers. That recoil pressure is MSFP.
Okay, that makes sense. So our interventions are doing one of two things. Either we're adding total volume with fluids, trying to increase both unstressed and ultimately stressed volume.
Right, pouring more water onto the sponge.
Or, perhaps more cleverly sometimes, we're increasing the effectiveness of the volume that's already there by manipulating venous tone.
That's precisely the mechanism of action for vasopressors like norepinephrine and phenylephrine when we think about their effect on MSFT. They are potent venoconstrictors.
Squeezing the sponge.
They squeeze the sponge. They reduce venous compliance. They stiffen the venous walls, effectively shrinking the capacity of that unstressed reservoir. This action physically squeezes blood out of the unstressed compartment and forces it into the stressed compartment.
So you convert unstressed volume into stressed volume.
You convert it. And the result is a rapid, often sharp, increase in MSFP, even though the total blood volume hasn't changed at all. It's like turning on a massive internal blood transfusion instantly by mobilizing the patient's own reservoir.
Wow, okay. The reverse is the disaster scenario we talked about with anesthetic induction, propofol being a potent venodilator.
Exactly. Propofol does the opposite. It increases venous compliance, relaxes those venous walls, almost like giving a potent sympathetic blocker.
So the sponge gets bigger, more floppy.
The sponge gets bigger and floppier. It allows that precious stressed volume, the volume generating pressure, to just relax back into the now expanded unstressed compartment.
So MSFP plummets.
It plummets. If you start with a baseline MSFP of, say, 8 mmHg, giving propofol might drop it to 5 mmHg almost instantly. The driving gradient is slashed, VR collapses, and the patient becomes hypotensive.
And you emphasize this happens before significant myocardial depression usually kicks in.
Yes, the negative inotropy from propofol is definitely a factor, especially at higher doses or in sick hearts. But that initial rapid drop in MSFP due to venodilation is often the immediate killer, the primary VR mechanism. It's a direct effect on venous smooth muscle compliance.
You mentioned MSFP is hard to measure directly, but surely there are ways people are trying to estimate this critical driving pressure clinically. Mm. Are we moving beyond just CVP?
Oh, absolutely. This is where advanced hemodynamic monitoring techniques come in. While stopping flow entirely is out, we can get clues by using transient ventilator maneuvers.
Like inspiratory or expiratory holds?
Exactly. There are methods using brief inspiratory holds where you look at the decay of the airway pressure, or more commonly now, methods using an expiratory hold maneuver. During a prolonged expiratory hold, venous return transiently drops towards zero.
Okay.
By analyzing the relationship between the falling cardiac output or surrogate like arterial pressure and the rising RAP during that hold, you can extrapolate back to estimate the pressure at which flow would cease entirely. That zero flow pressure is theoretically MSFP.
So you're using the ventilator to briefly perturb the system and see where flow stops.
Essentially, yes. There are also simpler methods looking at airway occlusion pressures like POC or using specific algorithms built into some monitors that try to estimate MSFP based on these dynamic changes. It's an active area of research and development.
But the key conceptual shift is moving beyond just looking at static pressures like CVP and starting to think about and ideally estimate that upstream driving pressure, MSFP.
It elevates the whole conversation, doesn't it? It moves us from just asking, is the CVP high or low? To asking, is my estimated MSFP sufficient to overcome this patient's RAP and drive adequate flow?
And we shouldn't forget positioning again, reverse Trendelenburg.
Right. It reduces the effect of MSFP gradient. Gravity pulls blood away from the thorax, reducing the pressure head, driving flow back. It's like lowering the water level in the part of the tank closest to the outlet pipe.
Whereas Trendelenburg does the opposite, at least transiently.
Transiently, yes. It shifts blood centrally, effectively boosting MSFP for a short time.
Okay, let's quickly revisit that trauma case. If we choose an induction agent like ketamine instead of propofol.
Big difference. Ketamine tends to preserve or even increase sympathetic tone.
Right, it's known for that.
So it maintains that venoconstriction, it keeps converting unstressed volume to stressed volume, and therefore it helps protect the MSFP, even if the patient is starting out hypovolemic.
It supports the engine pressure.
It supports the engine pressure. It's really the difference between predictive physiology-based care and just reacting to the chaos after the pressure crashes. Knowing propofol acts like a chemical phlebotomist, dropping MSFP,
Right.
means you either choose a different agent, like ketamine or etomidate in high-risk patients, or you have to be ready to preemptively support MSFP, perhaps with a bolus of phenylephrine or starting more epinephrine before you push the propofol.
Fix the engine before you floor the accelerator.
That's a good way to put it.
Okay, we've established MSFP as the engine, the driving force. Now let's tackle the brake, right? Atrial pressure, RIP. This is the downstream pressure that actively fights against venous return, the pressure we estimate clinically with CVP. When RIP rises, the gradient shrinks and flow stalls.
Yeah, the tricky thing with RAP or CVP is that while it is related to preload, thinking of it primarily as preload can be misleading. It's often much more useful to think of it as the opposition to flow, the back pressure.
Yeah.
When RAP goes up, for whatever reason, flow's going to suffer.
And in the RR setting, what are the major things that cause RAP to rise significantly?
We see two massive drivers clinically. First is the function of the right ventricle itself, and second is the pressure surrounding the heart, the intrathoracic pressure, which we directly manipulate.
Okay, let's start with RV function. Why does RV failure cause such a sudden, often critical rise in RAP?
Well, the RV is designed as a thin-walled volume handling chamber. It's meant to pump blood into the low-pressure pulmonary circulation.
Right, it doesn't normally face much resistance.
Exactly. But if it suddenly faces high resistance, maybe from a massive pulmonary embolism, drastically increasing pulmonary vascular resistance, PVR, or if the RV muscle itself fails due to an RV infarction, it simply cannot effectively eject its stroke volume into the pulmonary artery.
So the blood backs up.
The blood backs up almost immediately into the right atrium. There's nowhere else for it to go. This backup causes RAP to spike upwards, sometimes very rapidly.
And that directly narrows the MSFP RAP gradient.
It narrows the gradient, crushing venous return. And what makes high RAP from RV failure particularly dangerous is that the ventricle is already failing, and the high RAP itself further impairs its function by pushing it onto the descending limb of its own Starling curve. It's a vicious cycle.
This completely changes our therapeutic strategy, doesn't it? If a patient is hypotensive, low CO, but you notice their RAP or CVP is already high because of suspected RV failure, giving them a fluid bolus seems like the worst thing you could do.
It's often malpractice, frankly. Fluid loading in that situation just increases RAP even further, potentially reducing the gradient to near zero and worsening RV distension. It drives the system towards circulatory collapse.
So what do you do?
the focus shifts entirely away from volume. You need to decrease the RV afterload if possible. So maybe things like pulmonary vasodilators, optimizing ventilation to minimize PVR. And you need to support RV contractility, often with tailored inotropes.
Or dobutamine.
Dobutamine can be good because it provides inotropy and also some pulmonary vasodilation, reducing RV afterload. Sometimes milrinone. Or maybe even careful use of vasopressors that might support systemic pressure without excessively increasing PVR. It's complex RV-focused management.
Okay, that's RV failure. What about the second major determinant of REP, the one we control directly, intrathoracic pressure, ITP?
Right. We control ITP constantly with mechanical ventilation.
How does that work?
Well, positive pressure ventilation, especially when we add positive end expiratory pressure, PEEP, fundamentally increases the pressure inside the chest cavity.
Pushes air in, pressure goes up.
Pressure goes up. And since the right atrium and the great veins entering it are located inside the chest, the pressure surrounding them increases. For the heart to maintain its filling volume against this higher external pressure, the pressure inside the right atrium, RAP, must also rise, often almost proportionally.
So PEEP directly translates to higher RAP.
It does. This is the physiological price we pay for the benefits of mechanical ventilation and PEEP.
And what's the bottom line clinical consequence of this iatrogenic rise in RAP caused by our ventilator?
It's that narrowing of the gradient again. Simple example. Say a patient has a stable MSFP of 10 millimole Hg and a baseline RAP of 5 millimole Hg when breathing spontaneously. Their driving gradient is 10-5 equals 5 millimole Hg. Yeah. Now we intubate them and put them on PEEP 10, and let's say that increases their RAP to 8 millimole Hg. Now the gradient is only 10-8 equals 2 millimole Hg.
Wow, the gradient just collapsed.
It collapsed. Flow has potentially dropped by 60%, leading directly to hypotension or reduced cardiac output. And this effect is especially lethal in patients who are already hypovolemic because their starting MSFP is low to begin with. A small rise in RAP can obliterate their already meager gradient.
We even see this principle subtly with certain drugs, right? Like low-dose nitroglycerin.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Nitroglycerin at low doses is primarily a venodilator. We often use it to reduce RV preload and heart failure by increasing venous capacitance.
Right, makes the veins hold more blood.
Which can lower RAP. In some situations, paradoxically, by lowering an excessively high RP, it might actually improve the MSFT or IP gradient and increase VR, but you have to be incredibly careful because it also drops MSFP via venodilation and can cause systemic hypotension. It's a delicate balance.
Okay, so back to that trauma patient example. They're dry, low MSFP. You intubate and put them on the ventilator with, say, 10 of PEEP.
You're delivering a double hit. You're pushing RAP high with the PEEP, directly fighting against their already low MSFP. The gradient collapses.
And the action is?
Immediate. Minimize the PEEP to the lowest acceptable level for oxygenation. Ensure the tidal volume isn't excessive, as that also increases ITP. And, crucially, address the low MSFP, give volume, give pressors. But the key mental shift is to interpret that CVK reading not just as preload, but as the relentless brake opposing venous return. How high is the brake pedal pushed?
Okay, engine, MSFP checked, brake, RAP checked. Now let's focus on the third piece of the puzzle. Tubular water bottles, venous resistance, the bottleneck in the pipe. This feels like the silent variable sometimes, the one that trips us up when MSFP seems adequate and RAP doesn't seem excessively high, but flow is still poor.
It absolutely can be the silent variable.
Yeah.
You're right. The vast majority of resistance in the circulation is on the arterial side, the SVR that we manage all the time. But the venous system, while normally low resistance, is highly sensitive to certain changes. Even small increases in venous resistance can significantly throttle that VR flow rate. 5 year REP is MSFP, RAP, RV, if you will. If 5L goes up, VR goes down.
And what are the main factors we encounter in our environment that can acutely increase trouble in her?
I think we see three main culprits pretty regularly. First, it's the physical characteristics of the blood itself, blood viscosity.
Like engine oil getting thicker in the cold.
Exactly like that. Poiseuille's law, the physics of fluid flow in tubes, tells us that resistance is highly dependent on the viscosity of the fluid. So if a patient is severely dehydrated or maybe has been aggressively diuresed.
Or has underlying polycythemia.
Or underlying polycythemia, right. They can develop hemoconcentration. The blood literally gets thicker. And thicker blood requires a greater pressure gradient, MSFP, RAP, to maintain the same flow rate through the venous system. This subtle increase in PolarOS can contribute to refractory hypotension, especially after induction in a patient you didn't realize was quite so dehydrated.
Okay, viscosity. What's number two?
Number two is external compression. This is often something the surgeon introduces, Not us directly, but we absolutely have to manage the physiological fallout.
Like retractors or?
Retractors are a classic example, especially in abdominal or pelvic surgery, pressing on the iliac veins or the vena cava. But the most dramatic example we see routinely is during laparoscopic surgery.
The pneumoperitoneum.
Creating that gas bubble in the abdomen significantly increases intra-abdominal pressure, IAP. If that IAP gets high enough to exceed the pressure inside the inferior vena cava, the IVC.
It squashes the IVC flat.
It squashes it flat, or at least partially collapses it. That causes a massive spike in venous resistance for all the blood trying to return from the lower body, which is most of it. It effectively puts a chokehold on the main venous return pathway. We can see similar effects from large abdominal tumors or massive ascites, too.
Okay, so viscosity, external compression. What's the third factor increasing Krebs?
The third one is related to patient positioning again. Specifically that reverse Trendelenburg position we keep coming back to. We talked about how it reduces effective MSFP.
Right, by pooling blood away.
But it also fundamentally increases ordinal valors because of hydrostatics.
How so?
Well, when you tilt the patient head up, blood pools in the dependent veins of the legs and pelvis. This creates a vertical column of blood that exerts hydrostatic pressure. For venous blood to flow uphill from the legs back to the heart against gravity.
It has to overcome that extra pressure.
It has to overcome that gravitational resistance. This significantly increases the effective resistance to venous return from those dependent regions. So reverse Trendelenburg is a double whammy. It reduces the driving pressure gradient and increases the resistance. Both suppress VR.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, what about our anesthetic drugs? We established that propofol is a venodilator, which drops MSFP. But shouldn't vasodilation technically decrease resistance? RVNA. Make the pipe wider.
That's a really important point. And yes, technically venodilation does decrease RVO2A. Widening the venous channels should, in isolation, make it easier for blood to flow.
So why is the net effect still decreased VR?
Because the simultaneous reduction in the driving pressure, the MSFP drop caused by that same venodilation, is so profound and hemodynamically dominant. The loss of the engine's push, MSFP, far outweighs any small benefit gained from making the pipe slightly wider, lower torii. The collapse of the gradient is the overwhelming factor, leading to a net decrease in venous return.
Got it. The hit to MSFP is just much bigger than the benefit to torii valors. So let's put it together. If we have persistent hypotension during, say, a laparoscopic cholecystectomy in reverse Trendelenburg.
Okay, common scenario.
We could have a multimodal VR assault happening, right? We might have sevoflurane causing venodilation and dropping MSFP.
Yep, MSFP is down.
We have high intra-abdominal pressure from the insufflation, physically compressing the IVC and spiking torii.
And torii valor is up due to compression.
And we have the reverse Trendelenburg position causing blood pooling and adding hydrostatic resistance, further increasing effective valors.
Torii valor is up again due to gravity. And maybe MSFP is effectively lower, too. It's a triple or quadruple hit.
So the playbook in that situation has to address potentially all these factors.
Absolutely. You might need to reduce the volatile agent concentration. You definitely need to support MSFP, probably with fluids initially, if appropriate, but very likely with vasopressors like phenylephrine or norepinephrine. And you should communicate with the surgical team, is it possible to transiently lower the insufflation pressure? Even a temporary reduction can sometimes significantly improve VR by relieving that IVC compression.
So we have to remember, $20 is that often forgotten component.
Yeah.
If you think you've optimized MSFT volume tone and RIP, PPRV function, seems okay, but flow is still stubbornly low. Look for the bottleneck. Is it viscosity? Is it compression? Is it positioning?
Exactly. Don't forget the resistance term in the equation.
Okay, let's dedicate a specific focus to intrathoracic pressure, ITP. Because while we've touched on how it affects RAP, it feels like it's the single most immediate, powerful, and constantly modulated way that we, the anesthesiologist, manipulate the venous return gradient through mechanical ventilation. It really is like the gatekeeper, isn't it?
It truly is. ITP is the pressure within the pleural space, the pressure surrounding the heart, and the great vessels inside the chest. And understanding how our ventilator settings either assist or impede venous flow by changing ITP is absolutely fundamental.
Let's start with the natural state.
Yeah.
Someone breathing spontaneously. When you or I take a normal breath in, the diaphragm contracts and descends, the chest wall expands. What happens to ITP?
It becomes negative. The expanding thoracic cavity creates a subatmospheric pressure, maybe -5 to -8 centimeter eros, during a normal inspiration.
And what does that negative pressure do to venous return?
It acts like a vacuum pump. That negative ITP literally sucks blood into the chest. It pulls on the walls of the compliant right atrium and the vena cava, actively lowering RAP.
So it widens the MSFP-REP gradient.
It widens the gradient, sometimes quite significantly during inspiration. This actively increases venous return. Spontaneous inspiration naturally augments VR and CO. It's why you can sometimes see the arterial pressure waveform rise slightly during inspiration and dip during expiration in a spontaneously breathing patient, the respiratory pump effect.
But the moment we take over ventilation with positive pressure, we completely invert that entire dynamic.
We flip it 180 degrees. When we deliver a positive pressure breath with the ventilator, we are forcing air in, which increases ITT.
Right.
That positive pressure surrounding the heart directly raises RAP, as we discussed. It narrows the MSFP-RAP gradient and actively suppresses venous return during the inspiratory phase.
And this suppression is dose-dependent.
Very much so. The higher the peak inspiratory pressure, the longer the inspiratory time, the larger the tidal volume, basically, the higher the mean airway pressure, the greater the increase in mean ITP, and the worse the suppression of venous return.
Okay, and then there's PEEP, positive and expiratory pressure, which adds another layer of complexity.
PEEP is, in many ways, a constant adversary of venous return. Unlike the intermittent pressure rise during inspiration, PEEP maintains a positive pressure in the alveoli, and thus in the thorax, throughout the entire respiratory cycle, including expiration.
So it provides a continuous baseline elevation of ITP and therefore RAP.
Exactly. It leads to persistently elevated mean RAP, which means a persistently narrowed gradient and suppressed VR 24/7, as long as the PEEP is applied. We often absolutely need it for oxygenation and lung recruitment, especially in ARDS or stiff lungs.
But we pay a circulatory price.
We always pay a circulatory price. And it's not just the effect on RAP. Remember that PEEP increases lung volume, which can compress pulmonary capillaries and increase pulmonary vascular resistance, PVR.
Ah, so it increases the afterload on the right ventricle too.
It does. So PEEP can hit VR from both sides, increases RAP, reducing the gradient, and increases RV afterload, potentially impairing RV function, which further increases RAP.
Now, how much of the PEEP we dial in actually gets transmitted to the pleural space and affects RAP? Is it always one-to-one?
No, not at all. The transmission coefficient is highly variable and depends critically on the compliance of the lungs and chest wall.
Okay, explain that.
In patients with healthy, compliant lungs, lungs that inflate easily, a large portion of the PEEP applied at the airway gets transmitted through to the pleural space. The transmission coefficient might be high, maybe 50%, even up to 80% in some cases. So PEEP 10 could easily increase RAP by 5 to 8 centimeter arrow.
Okay, high transmission in compliant lungs.
But in patients with stiff, non-compliant lungs, like severe ARDS, where the lungs are like concrete, the applied PEEP pressure tends to be absorbed or dissipated just trying to open the stiff alveoli. Much less pressure gets transmitted to the pleural space.
So the transmission coefficient is lower?
Much lower. It might only be 20% or even less. So in that severe ARDS patient, PEEP 10 might only increase RAP by 1 or 2 centimeter ratio.
That is a vital clinical distinction. It means that the same level of PEEP, say 10 centimeter HO, might be hemodynamically catastrophic in a relatively healthy, compliant lung patient, especially hypovolemic, but barely noticeable in terms of VR impact in a patient with truly stiff ARDS lungs.
Precisely. You have more leeway with PEEP hemodynamically when the lungs are very sick and stiff. The anesthesiologist has to constantly perform this balancing act. How much PEEP do I need for adequate oxygenation versus how much circulatory compromise, suppressed VR, increased RV afterload, can this patient tolerate?
And we also see the reverse effect during emergence, right, when we take patients off the ventilator.
Absolutely. That moment when you disconnect the ventilator, the patient starts taking strong, spontaneous breaths, the ITP immediately swings negative during inspiration. RIP drops instantly. That MSC's PRIP gradient widens dramatically.
And VR surges back.
VR surges back, CO climbs. And we often see that classic, sometimes quite marked, transient rise in blood pressure right around extubation. The respiratory pump is kicking back in.
So the clear lesson here is be incredibly wary of PEEP, especially higher levels, in patients who might already have compromised RV function or a high baseline RAP, like someone with chronic pulmonary hypertension.
You have to be exceptionally judicious. Adding significant PEEP in that situation risks completely collapsing the venous return gradient and precipitating acute right heart failure. Minimize PEEP, optimize RV function first if you can. Respect the gatekeeper. So, okay, so this brings us to the really practical part. The integrated bedside framework. How do we take all this guidance physics, MSFP, RAP, primer belly, the curves, and actually convert it into a concrete, usable playbook when the patient in front of us becomes hypotensive?
Yeah, how do we operationalize this? The first step, it seems, has to be acknowledging the limitations of our traditional measures. We absolutely have to discard relying on static preload indices like a single CVP reading.
Completely useless in isolation for predicting fluid responsiveness. We've known this for years. A patient can have a low CVP and be totally unresponsive to fluids, or they could have a CVP of 15 and still be on the steep responsive part of their Frank-Starlin curve.
So fluid responsiveness isn't about the absolute CVP. It's about predicting whether giving more volume will actually shift that VR curve rightward enough to push the operating point up the CO curve and increase cardiac output.
Exactly. And to predict that, we need dynamic indices, not static ones. In patients who are fully mechanically ventilated with no spontaneous effort.
The key condition.
The absolute key condition. We can look at the respiratory variation in the arterial pressure waveform or stroke volume. That's pulse pressure variation, PPV, or stroke volume variation, SVV.
And why do these dynamic indices work? How do they reflect fluid responsiveness?
They work precisely because positive pressure ventilation cyclically suppresses venous return during inspiration, as we just discussed. If the patient is fluid responsive, meaning they're operating on the steep, ascending part of their cardiac function curve, that cyclic drop in VR during inspiration will cause a significant measurable drop in stroke volume and pulse pressure.
Because the heart's output is very sensitive to small changes in preload.
Exactly. High PPV or SVV tells you the patient is sensitive to preload changes. Conversely, if the patient is not fluid responsive, maybe they're already on the flat part of their Starling curve, or their RV is failing. That same cyclic drop in VR won't cause much change in stroke volume. The variation will be minimal.
So low PPV SVV tells you giving more fluids is unlikely to help CO and will probably just increase RDP further.
Precisely. It signals that fluids are off the table for now, which leads directly into our vasopressor strategy. If the patient is hypotensive, likely due to low MSFP, think sepsis, post-induction vasodilation, and they're not fluid responsive, low PPV SVV.
Then norepinephrine is your friend.
Norepinephrine is your absolute best friend. Because remember, it's not just an arterial pressure agent. It's a potent venoconstrictor. It acts as an effective volume expander.
Squeezing the sponge again.
Squeezing the sponge, mobilizing maybe 500 to 700 milliliters of the patient's own blood from the unstressed into the stress volume compartment. That directly increases MSFP, shifts the VR curve right, and restores the driving gradient. It's often the primary way to manage low MSFP when fluids aren't working or aren't appropriate.
And this framework also informs our choice of anesthetic agent right from the start, doesn't it? It's fundamentally an MSFP decision.
It absolutely is. We cannot treat every patient with the same induction agent. In the critically ill, the hypovolemic, the trauma patient, the patient with sepsis, you strongly consider agents that preserve sympathetic tone and thus protect MSFP.
Ketamine, etomidate.
Ketamine or etomidate. Because you anticipate their MSFP is already low or fragile. In a young, healthy euvolemic patient having minor surgery, the transient MSFP drop from propofol or sevoflurane is usually well tolerated and easily managed. But the agent choice itself is a proactive decision about protecting the VR engine based on the patient's physiology.
This all hinges, then, on adopting a different monitoring mindset. We have to stop seeing CVP as volume status. CVP is RAP. It tells you about the brake pedal.
It's the brake. Maybe a little bit about RV function, too. But it tells you next to nothing definitive about the engine pressure, MSFP, or the state of the venous reservoir. We have to use our dynamic metrics, PPV, SVV, maybe echo findings like IVC variability, our clinical context, and our understanding of physiology to infer the state of MSFT and the likely responsiveness to interventions.
Okay, so let's formalize that rapid-fire assessment when the monitor alarm's BP is dropping. We need to move past the simple reactive give a fluid bolus and ask the three governing questions derived from the Guyton model.
Exactly, question one.
Question one, is MSFP likely low? Ask yourself, has there been significant bleeding or fluid loss? Did I just give a known venodilator like propofol or spinal anesthetic? Is the patient septic? If the answer points towards yes,
then the potential treatments are fluids, but only if dynamic metrics like PPV, SVV support fluid responsiveness, or often more effectively in vasodilated states, vasopressors like norepinephrine or phenylephrine to directly increase venous tone and boost MSFP.
Okay, question two. Is RAP likely inappropriately high? Ask, is the right ventricle potentially failing? Look for echo signs, POCUS, high baseline CVP. Is my PEEP setting or tidal volume potentially excessive for this patient's condition?
If the answer here seems to be yes, the action is not fluids. It's to reduce the offending ITP, lower the PEEP, reduce the tidal volume if possible. And if RD failure is the primary suspicion, you need to think about specific RV support inotropes, pulmonary vasodilators.
Got it. And question three, is venous resistance likely high? Ask, is the patient severely dehydrated, leading to high viscosity? Is the surgeon leaning on the IVC or is the abdomen insufflated to high pressure? Is the patient in a steep reverse Trendelenburg position?
If yes seems likely here, the actions are different again. Correct the dehydration if possible, which might involve fluids paradoxically, but to fix viscosity, not just volume, communicate with the surgeon about retractors or insufflation pressure. Or, if feasible, adjust the patient's position to reduce hydrostatic resistance.
And only after systematically thinking through these three primary determinants of venous return, MSFP, RIP, and trivolars, do we then consider the pump itself.
That's the logical flow. If you've optimized the gradient, MSFP is adequate, RIP is minimized, RF failure is addressed, and the patient is still hypotensive and determined not to be fluid responsive, then and only then do you strongly suspect a primary cardiac contractility problem. That's when you reach for inotropes to shift that CO curve upward.
It provides a much more structured physiology-based approach to hypotension than just reflexively giving fluid or pressors.
It moves from reacting to predicting.
Okay, let's really cement this by applying the integrated framework back to those initial clinical scenarios you raised. That should help synthesize the whole VR model.
Good idea. Let's take case one, the patient in septic shock who needs general anesthesia. This is a classic VR challenge.
Right. You described it as a double hit on the VR gradient. How so again?
Well, sepsis causes massive systemic vasodilation. That directly translates to a low mean systemic filling pressure, MSFP. The venous reservoir is leaky and relaxed. The driving pressure is down.
So the VR curve is already shifted left.
Already shifted left. Then you put the patient on mechanical ventilation, likely needing some PEEP for potential ARDS or oxygenation issues. That PEEP increases intrathoracic pressure, raising RAP.
So the gradient, MSFP-RAP, is getting squeezed from both ends. Low MSFP, high RAP.
Exactly. The gradient collapses. The primary failure here is usually the profoundly low MSFP caused by the septic vasodilation. So the key initial action is almost always high-dose norepinephrine.
To aggressively shift that VR curve back to the right by increasing venous tone and MSFP.
Precisely. Restore the driving pressure. You titrate the norepinephrine, often to quite high doses, while simultaneously ensuring the PEEP is set only to the minimum level required for acceptable oxygenation to minimize the iatrogenic increase in RAP. Fluids might play a role early on if they are responsive, but pressors are usually the cornerstone for fixing the MSFP.
Makes sense. Okay, case two, laparoscopic surgery, especially in reverse Trendelenburg. What's the primary VR challenge here?
Here, the main assault is often on venous resistance, with a secondary hit to MSFP. The pneumoperitoneum, the gas insufflation, directly increases intra-abdominal pressure.
Compressing the IVC.
Compressing the IVC, spiking Raters. Then the reverse Trendelenburg positioning adds that hydrostatic resistance, further increasing effective trivesals. And on top of that, your volatile anesthetic is likely causing some vasodilation, suppressing MSFP a bit.
So high resistance, maybe slightly low driving pressure?
That's the picture. The action plan has to be multifaceted. First, manage the MSFP, minimize the volatile agent concentration if possible. Consider preemptive or early use of a vasopressor, like phenylephrine or low-dose norepinephrine to counteract the venodilation. Second, address the trivol, communicate with the surgical team. Can the insufflation pressure be safely minimized? Even a drop from 15 to 12 millimeter HG can make a difference. Third, optimize volume status beforehand if possible.
So you're manipulating MSFP and dry valves simultaneously?
You have to. It's rarely just one thing in that scenario.
Okay, final case. Case three, that moment of emergence, transitioning back to spontaneous breathing. You called this the physiological restoration of flow.
Yeah, it's like opening the floodgates. As soon as the patient starts taking effective spontaneous breaths where you disconnect the ventilator.
The ITP turns negative during inspiration.
That negative ITP sucks blood in, RIP instantly drops, the MSFP RIP gradient widens dramatically.
And VR surges.
VR and consequently CO rapidly climb. This is physiology working for you for a change, but you have to anticipate the consequences. That surge in CO can translate into a sudden rise in blood pressure, sometimes significant hypertension.
Especially in patients with underlying stiff vasculature or maybe borderline heart failure.
Exactly. They might not handle that sudden volume load well, potentially risking acute pulmonary edema. So the key action here is anticipation. Be ready to manage that potential BP spike, maybe by adjusting antihypertensives or ensuring adequate analgesia sedation to blunt sympathetic response.
So the overarching synthesis from these cases seems clear.
I think so. Hypotension in the operating room, or critical care for that matter, is rarely just low preload or bad heart. It is almost always a dynamic imbalance within the Guyton framework, an issue with MSFP, RAP, or true others, or usually some combination. The anesthesiologist's predictive power, our ability to manage hemodynamics proactively, hinges on assessing these three interdependent variables.
This has been a really fantastic, comprehensive deep dive into, well, how circulation actually works under anesthesia, viewed through the lens of venous return. If there's one core takeaway, it has to be constantly coming back to that simple governing equation, doesn't it? The flow back to the heart, VGOAO, is determined by the pressure pushing it, MSFP.
The engine.
Minus the pressure opposing it, RAP.
The brake.
All divided by the resistance in the pipes.
The bottleneck. Use that visualization every single day. When you give fluids or vasopressors, you are primarily trying to fill the tank or increase venous tone that's boosting MSFP, tuning the engine.
Right.
When you apply PEEP, or when the RV starts to fail, you are effectively pressing the brake pedal harder that's increasing RAE, the opponent.
Got it.
And when you deal with patient positioning, surgical compression, or severe dehydration, you're dealing with narrowing the pipe that's increasing car avails, the bottleneck.
Thinking about it that way, engine, brake, bottleneck really helps clarify intervention targets. Mm-hmm. Moving from just reacting to predicting physiology seems to be about visualizing your planned intervention on those Guyton curves in your mind's eye.
That's the challenge. Ask yourself, does this drug I'm about to give shift the VR curve right or left? Does this change in ventilator setting push the patient's operating point down into a dangerous low-flow state? Am I addressing the right part of the equation?
It forces a more mechanistic approach.
It does. So our final provocative thought, maybe, is to challenge you, the listener, to always try and visualize your next hemodynamic intervention, whether it be a drug, a fluid bolus, a ventilator change, a position change within this Guyton context. Use the map. Use the framework. Move beyond just chasing numbers and towards targeted, predictive, physiology-driven patient care. This deep dive, hopefully, gives you the foundational confidence to manage every hemodynamic swing with that kind of precision.
Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.